Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are reading the Ratification Bates of Virginia. Hope you are learning something. There's no doubt that you are. But what we want to do is we want to help you have such a good understanding that you can get more involved. This show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you're listening to the only show that gives you the academic solutions as well as the academic evidence why we need to institute Republic Review, which is the only academic-based solution to getting the federal government into compliance. We have a comment line. Now, one of the things I want to tell you kind of follows up with some conversations I've had, and I'm in contact with a lot of people working in the Constitution Party and the National Liberty Alliance and so forth. And so one of the things I keep telling them, and I haven't had a chance possibly to put this out to you, but get involved with the Constitution Party and the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party won't let you join them if you are a member of the Constitution Party. And I don't want you to sign something that's basically going to have you lie. But I have a problem with that type of exclusivity when it comes to parties. I believe that if you're a Constitution Party member, your standards and your platform is well above and beyond the Republican Party platform. So in other words, you not only support that, but you actually support even more. You go much further. And so, in other words, the platform isn't constitutional enough. But the reason why you go to the Republican Party, because after you go once or twice, somebody's going to come up to you and say, hey, I've noticed you've been here a couple of times. What you think? Why don't you join? And then you can start pointing out, why is it you offer no training on the Constitution? And you, as somebody that has been listening to the Ratification Debates and has access to videos and so forth, and we will be working with the Constitution Party in making some really good videos that we're going to take you into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution. Every video training I've seen regarding the Constitution is just inadequate. And so we have to have a thorough, so that we can point to it and say, you want a thorough understanding of the Constitution? Here you go. This is better than Hillsdale College. This is better than anything out there, because we clarify, one, what the Constitution is, and we will go through what each line means based on the ratification debates. So in other words, we're going to start at a high level, go at the real macro, looking at constitutions, looking at our Constitution, and then looking at an overview of our Constitution, and then going into the articles and the amendments and so forth, and drilling in and drilling in and drilling in. This way, you'll kind of have a 100 view, a 200 level view, like in education, 300, 500, and so forth. This way, you will be able to have an offer to the Republican Party some really top-notch training. Now, we're not talking about really ooh, gee whiz, you know, neat graphics type of stuff. This is just going to be ooh, gee whiz academics. So as you're going, then you can start waking up all these members, because you got to understand, those people who are going to the Republican Party, you know, every month, and after a while they get disenfranchised and they actually go, you know what, I'm tired of this, I'm leaving. And so that's what they end up doing. They basically burn out because they realize what they're doing has no real effect. And they're not doing what they thought they would be doing, really contributing in driving the party, you know, back on, you know, restoring our Constitution. And people don't even realize it's void of the Constitution. So what you do is you start attending and you just basically start pointing out to everybody when they come up to you and say, hey, heck, you want to join? And go, eh. And even if they find out that you're in a precinct that is unoccupied, that, hey, we could make you a precinct committee officer, PCO. Now, you know, I'm apprehensive in joining because you guys don't want to offer training. How about this? How about if I start offering training? And if, you know, if you guys really want to embrace the Constitution, then okay, I'll probably join. And I'm going to tell you what'll happen. As you start educating and as the eyes get widened, the chair is going to possibly talk to the state chair and other chairs to go, hey, we're getting this training. And I'm sure the state chair and some of the other blue chairs that are a part of the cabal within the blue state Republican Party, you will find that they'll go, you know what? You should not be training people on the Constitution. You need to be spending time on, you know, our agenda, because they're all agenda-driven. They don't care about the Constitution or the problems. They just want to make sure that they have Republicans in those seats so that those Republicans have the latitude to give the Democrats the latitude that they need, just like what Liz Cheney's been doing. So anyway, what we want you to do is we want you to actually help convert all of these people who are already motivated to getting involved and move them over into the Constitution Party. One of the other things you need to do is you need to start identifying who you're going to primary out the Republicans, because even though the person that's going to be running may be associated with the Constitution Party, what you want them to do is you want them to run as a Republican. And once the race is over, you can officially basically call out, you know, how the state has kind of turned their back on you at the state party. They really did nothing for you. And as far as I'm concerned, I am now officially a Constitution Party member. And then that seat becomes a Constitution Party seat. How's that grabbing you? That way, you don't have to fight through the thicket of getting the recognition of, wow, you know, how are you going to get people to vote on a third party when they're only going to vote for Republican? And then all of a sudden, when you get out there and you start actually communicating to the Republicans and everybody in your county, now you can actually be talking to them about the Constitution, why you switched over to the Constitution Party, and this helps wake people up. This actually brings people in droves to the Constitution Party when they're actually speaking about the truth. More importantly, especially when the Constitution Party makes the necessary changes that people, when they recognize it, they'll go, oh my gosh, like holding their politicians accountable. Holding their public servants accountable to the Constitution, focusing the platform on the Constitution, not a bunch of morality. The whole focus, if we want to start winning, we have to actually stop getting into theocracy, and we actually have to get into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution. It doesn't mean you lose your religion. What it means is you point out what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional. You want to have a pragmatic approach, because the moderates will look at you and go, you know what, that absolutely makes a point. Why? Because they've only heard points based on faith, you know, the secular godlessness of, oh, well, people have a right to choose for themselves. Well, it's not about choosing when the federal government has no right to dictate that this is what the law is. They don't have that authority. That is the winning argument. Especially regarding the moderates, especially regarding the facts on what is legal and what isn't legal. Now, it doesn't mean you don't have to become less religious and, you know, and look at abortion and pragmatically, personally. You can still look at abortion with, you know, at the most abhorrence as possible as a person. But as a politician, you have to be leading on what is the absolutely the right thing to do. And we're not talking in the moral thing. We're actually talking in the constitutional aspects of what is the right thing to do. And if you do that, I'm telling you, you're going to win more moderates, and more people are going to wake up and go, wow, I did not realize the the hard-defined limitations that the federal government has, that they don't have the power to dictate marriage. They don't have the power to dictate housing. They don't have the power to dictate what is being taught in the education. You want to win all of these little battles. It is when we use the Constitution as our weapon and as our defense. This way, they have nothing to defend. But when you get into theocratic arguments and positions, then you fail to position yourself on the Constitution. The Lord gave us the Constitution, and he knew we could use it without having to get into a religious battle. Anyway, let me kind of just tell you what we're doing. We're actually in the ratification debates. We are on June 12th. We already read Mr. Grayson previously, and we're now getting into Mr. Pendleton, and Mr. Pendleton is going to kind of highlight some common law for us. Then we will get into some direct taxes, as well as some new comments down the road, and way down the road, the next day on the June 14th by Mr. Madison. And you got to remember, June 14th is when it starts really heating up on martial law, okay, and the militia and so forth. So as we got 8 seconds. So take my words of my monologue to heart. Get involved. And if you want to lead, lead with the truth. And as a matter of fact, we've got more on how you can get more active and more involved by using the truth. Because when people recognize that you're speaking the truth, the argument is over. There you go. So we will be right back. And like I said, we'll be discussing Mr. Pendleton, Mr. Madison, and all of the good framers when we get back. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so we're kind of in the middle of Mr. Pendleton's oration. And so this is kind of this little snippet where he talks about trial by jury and common law. And he says, there will be deviations even in our state legislatures thus constituted, I say, and I hope to give no offense when I do. There have been some, I believe every gentleman will see, that it is unconstitutional to condemn any man without a fair trial. Such a condemnation is repugnant to the principles of justice. It is contrary to the Constitution and the spirit of the common law. Look at the Bill of Rights. Virginia actually had a Bill of Rights. You find there that no man shall be condemned without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, that every man has a right to call for evidence in his favor. Now, when you get a ticket, when you're being fined because you have a right to due process and you have a right to face your accusers and witnesses. And so when a camera takes a picture and says, you've done this, well, where is your accuser? If you understand how they're enforcing laws, then they're violating the Constitution by not allowing you to face your accuser and bring forth witnesses. And above all, to a speedy trial, but an impartial trial of the vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty. And so, when you look at a speedy trial, a fair trial, and a trial with impartial biases, sometimes you can't even do it within the vicinage, especially when the news media, politicians, and everybody else has ratcheted everything up with hyperbole. I mean, this George Floyd trial, how could anybody in America get a fair trial? I mean, what area the whole nation has burned? Or I should say, the whole nation has been wreaking the havoc of the communist Bolsheviks who are trying to drive this point that George Floyd was murdered, when actually the evidence now from the trial seems otherwise. Anyway, these principles have not been attended to, and an instance has been mentioned already where they have been in some degree violated. Now, see, this is a nice little, you know, golden nugget that he's talking about, and the importance of common law, and how even in those days, there were times when people didn't necessarily get their fair trial. Now, going on, as we kind of go on, Mr. Pendleton then addresses Mr. Monroe, or James Monroe, when James Monroe kind of threw out this, you know, speculation, and then asked some real questions. Well, let's look at this on this direct taxes. Now, Mr. Monroe's biggest problem, if I remember correctly, going through his different comments, his biggest problem was this concept of direct taxation. A gentleman, Mr. Monroe, has said that the power of direct taxation was unnecessary because the imposts and backlands would be abundantly sufficient to answer all federal purposes. If so, what are we disputing about? I asked the gentleman who made the observation and this committee if they believe the Congress will ever lay direct taxes if the other funds are sufficient. It will then remain a harmless power upon paper and do no injury. If it should be necessary, will gentlemen run the risk of the Union by withholding it? I was sorry to hear the subjects of requisition and taxation misinterpreted. The latter has been compared to taxation by Great Britain without our own consent. The two cases are by no means similar. The King of Great Britain has not the purse, though he holds the sword. He has no means of using the sword but by requisitions on those who hold the purse. He applied to the British Parliament, and they were pleased to trust him with our money. We declared, as we had right, that we ought to be taxed by our own representatives, and that therefore their disposing of our money without our consent was unjust. Here, requisitions are to be made by one body of our representatives to another. Why should this be the case when they are both possessed of our equal confidence, both chosen in the same manner and equally responsible to us? But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies, equally our representatives, and that the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners and for different purposes. the general government in great national concerns in which we are interested in common with other members of the union. The state legislatures in out mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers, our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property, as Virginians are still in the hands of our state legislature. If they prove to be feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of general government for security? The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes. Now, you got to understand what he just said. Our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property as Virginians are still in the hands of our state legislature. If they prove too feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes and act on different objects, so that notwithstanding what the worthy gentleman said, I believe I'm still correct and insist that if each power is confined within its proper bounds and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen. Being for two different purposes, as long as they are both limited to the different objects, they can no more clash than two parallel lines can meet. Both lay taxes, but for different purposes. The same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences. Now, here's the important part as well. This is key. It's the last sentence here. If an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose, this will be for the general purposes of the union and for the manifest interest of the states. There you go. Well, that fell down. Anyway, so as we move along and we kind of go down to, like I said, this is June 14th, and this is Mr. Madison. And Mr. Madison basically addresses the chair and states, "Mr. Chairman, let me ask those who oppose this part of the system whether any alteration would not make it equally or more liable to objections. Would it be better to fix their compensations? Would not this produce inconveniences? What authorizes us to conclude that the value of coins will continue always the same? Would it be prudent to make them dependent on the state governments for their salaries, on those who watch them with jealous eyes and who consider them as encroaching, not on the people but on themselves? But the worthy member supposes that Congress will fix their wages so low that only the rich can fill the offices of senators and representatives. Who are to appoint them? The rich? No, sir, the people are to appoint them. If the members of the general government were to reduce their compensations to trifle before the evil suggested could happen, the people could elect other members in their stead who would alter that regulation. The people do not choose them for their wealth. If the state legislatures choose such men as senators, it does not influence the people at large in their election of representatives. They can choose those who have the most merit and least wealth. If Congress reduces their wages to a trifle, what shall prevent the states from giving a man of merit so much as will be an adequate compensation? I think the evil very remote. And if it were now to happen, the remedy is in our hands and may by ourselves be applied." Now, so I've actually gone on the record to say we do not pay our legislatures enough. I mean, if you look at how much these men make in creating the law, and look how much lawyers make in defending people of the law. Are you kidding? I truly believe that we need, if you want politicians to not be looking over their shoulder to kind of cover their expenses and costs, they shouldn't be in the salary wages that are poverty level, they should be making decent wages so that, one, it can attract people from all different stations, but you have to make it so that they cannot accept money from anybody for any type of purposes. And during their elections, the only money they can receive, because, and you got to shut down this insider trading, but bottom line, back to these elections, all elections should be local. There should be no money coming across the city, legislative district, the county, or whatever the geographical boundary is, even if it's Congress. If it's the congressional district, no money should be coming from any other part of the United States or the world or the state that is outside that congressional district. We should not be allowing those types of dollars to be influencing, because who are these people to represent? The dollars coming from outside the district or the people that are inside the district? And remember, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so this is why you want to really get things down to a brass tacks. Make all elections local. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we're going to get into the militia, and we're going to get into martial law and some really meaty stuff. And this is, technically, if you look, we're on June 14th. And this is on a Saturday. And actually, if you look beforehand, I think June 13th, you'll find stuff regarding the militia. And so they really get heavy into this debate. And what I'm only highlighting just a few of the comments that they're making. The first comment is actually from the anti-federalist George Mason. And what he basically provides is he provides the recipe of how to basically violate the, this is all based on the premise that the federal government and the states would allow the violation of the Constitution and the basically the disbanding of the militia for something else, and in ultimately allowing the federal government to start enforcing their own laws instead of abiding by the Constitution. And so here you go, Mr. Chairman. unless there be some restrictions on the power of calling forth the militia. And oh, by the way, Mason was huge on trying to get an amendment to constraining the federal government and how they could use the militia. And he never got that amendment because the argument against it made more sense. Anyway, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. We may very easily see that it will produce dreadful oppressions. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. And we talk about dreadful oppressions. Let's think about the Bundys. Let's think about the Hammonds. Let's think about some of the, you know, the Ruby Ridge and some of these things that, you know, with Waco that just happened. I mean, we just had an anniversary of that. Let's think about how enforcement has killed people here in America, and there's been no accountability. It would be to use the militia to a very bad purpose. If any disturbance happened in New Hampshire, to call them from Georgia, this would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and establish a standing army. I conceive the general government ought to have the power over the militia, but it ought to have some bounds. If gentlemen say the militia of a neighboring state is not sufficient, the government ought to have the power to call forth those of other states, the most convenient and contiguous. But in this case, the consent of the legislatures ought to be had. On real emergencies, this consent will never be denied, each state being concerned in the safety of the rest. This power may be restricted without any danger. I wish such an amendment as this, that the militia of any state should not be marched beyond the limits of the adjoining state, and if it be necessary to draw them from one end of the continent to the other, I wish such a check as the consent of the state legislatures to be provided. Gentlemen may say, just think of how divided we are politically, that if it's a Democratic president and a Republican Congress and he wants to drag them or vice versa, how the partisanship would force those types of things to happen at the federal level, and at the state level, something different would happen. Gentlemen may say this would impede the government and that the state legislatures would counteract it by refusing their consent. This argument may be applied to all all objections whatsoever. How is this compared to the British Constitution? Though the king may declare war, the parliament has the means of carrying it on. It is not so here. Congress can do both, but where it not for that check in British government, the monarch would be the despot. When a war is necessary for the benefit of the nation, the means of carrying it on are never denied. If any unjust requisition be made on Parliament, it will be, as it ought to be, refused. The same principle ought to be observed in our government. In times of real danger, the states will have the same enthusiasm in aiding the general government in granting its demands, which is seen in England when the king is engaged in war apparently for the interest of the nation. This power is necessary, but we ought to guard against danger. If ever they attempt to harass or abuse the militia, they may abolish them and raise a standing army in their stead. No, they can't. They would be violating the Constitution unless they amended the Constitution to allow them to do so. Right? They have to actually amend Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, the power shall have the power to call forth the militia. They would actually have to get rid of that and say that Congress now has the power to create a standing army to do this or that. And what ludicrous thing we would be giving up in securing ourselves to ensure we do not live under tyranny, as we the people would have to enforce federal law. Allowing them to enforce it means that they would inflict tyranny upon us. Anyway, going on, this is what he says. There are various ways of destroying the militia. Remember I told you, here's the recipe. A standing army may be perpetually established in their stead. I abominate and detest the idea of government where there is a standing army. What is a standing army? A standing army is the ability to enforce your own laws or to go fight your own wars. These people have the use of deadly force to ensure the results occur that they are seeking. If they want to take your money, they want to take your land, they have the application of deadly force, and that's what a standing army is. Anyway, Mason goes on and says, the militia may be destroyed here by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before. That is, by rendering them useless, by disarming them. That's what they're looking to do today, disarming the militia. Because who's the militia? We the people. It's still in the Constitution. We still have the responsibility of enforcing the Constitution. We don't have a right to own guns. We have a responsibility to possess guns and enforce the Constitution. Not by the Second Amendment, by Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, that we are to be called to execute the laws of the Union. Anyway, Mason goes on and says, under the various pretenses, Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and that the state governments cannot do it, for Congress has an exclusive right to arm them, and etc. Now, did you hear what he just said? Has an exclusive right to arm them, and etc., making sure that they have the training and so forth. See, some people, you know, kind of argue the point that, you know, Congress isn't responsible for actually equipping and training. And actually, they're accountable and responsible for funding the training and funding the arming. So if they stop doing it, then they would be violating the Constitution. But that's what they did. They stopped funding it. Anyway, he goes on. Here is a line of division drawn between them, the state and general governments. The power over the militia is divided between them. The national government has an exclusive right for providing for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The state governments have the power of appointing the officers and of training the militia. But again, who's funding it? As far as funding for the training and funding for the weaponry and army, to the discipline prescribed by Congress, if they should think proper to prescribe any. Should the national government wish to render the militia useless, they may neglect them and let them perish in order to have a pretense of establishing a standing army, which is exactly what happened with the Civil War, when Lincoln couldn't get the militia because these guys weren't motivated to going down, you know, in the service of their states and going after states that actually weren't trying to attack them. You got to remember, the South wasn't attacking the North. The North was attacking the South. The South had seceded. Now, I've said this before, and I'll be really quick. Had Lincoln allowed the South to secede and then declared war in the North, in the Western Hemisphere, on slavery, he would have avoided years of losses of battles. He would have avoided having to do the Emancipation Proclamation, and he would have avoided the loss of a lot of lives, because the North was more than willing to go and free the South. But the first half of that Civil War was about not letting him go. And he was absolutely wrong. Any state can secede. If you feel that there's a problem with the Constitution, or that the violations are too flagrant, then the contract is void. Anyway, as we move on, well, Madison kind of pipes up here now. But Madison follows Mason, and this is what he says. The Honorable, I love this, when Madison and some of these guys say it this way. The honorable member is under another mistake. He wishes martial law to be exercised only in time of war, under an idea that Congress can establish it in time of peace. So you have to understand that only in the time of war, they cannot. They cannot. Let me emphasize this. They cannot declare martial law because of a pandemic. Is that a war? Only in the time of war. Congress, and now because the 14th Amendment, the states and Congress cannot establish it in a time of peace. And so when we come back, we will just pick up where Madison wanted to take us, and we will be right back after these promos. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so actually, let me kind of start off when Madison actually engages Mason, because actually I realized I missed a point, and it's worth going over. Mr. Madison basically starts off with his cordial, Mr. Chairman, I most cordially, see he actually uses the word cordial, I most cordially agree with the honorable member last up, that a standing army is one of the greatest mischiefs that can possibly happen. Now, remember what I just told you about a standing army. What is a standing army? It's not just a U.S. army that exists forever like we have. A standing army is the enforcement capability of the government. Remember, our enforcement and the fighting of wars was to be done by the militia, because the army and militia was synonymous. The only way we would have had an army. So one of the things that they did historically was when we created these territories, well, gosh, we had to have the cavalry. So they created these regular services to patrol the territory, because Congress had exclusive rights of legislation over all territories. So they created a huge employment opportunity for people that wanted to ride around and kill, you know, Indians, and or just to be out and earning money, you know, be out in the sun and the fresh air. But the point is that when the territories became states, well, what did they do with the cavalry? What did they do with these institutions? Well, some of these people actually lost their jobs, but they did everything they could to protect that little power. This is why they created the Department of Home, or the Department of Interior, in 1849. 1849, the the continent was pretty much sealed up from sea, from the East Coast to West Coast, that we owned all of the land. We had the territory, and each territory was being carved into states, and almost every part of that territory was well on the way of becoming Washington, Oregon, Utah, Nevada, and so forth. And so even though some of the states may have came, you know, it's interesting, Oklahoma didn't become a state until 1906, where most of the other states in the West became states well before then, 40, 50 years before then. Isn't that interesting? Because the federal government had these machinations, or the people that were working, the bureaucrats, they wanted to maintain this power and this huge office of employment and employing people. So they started creating ways that they think they could have possessed land without amending the Constitution, such as territories or such as reservations. So I digress, but the fact of the matter is they never amended the Constitution, and the states never formally allowed them to create these reservations for people, trees, for environmentally challenged fleas or what have you. Fact of the matter is they were making it up as they went along. They were violating the Constitution, and they bamboozled the states because they said, oh, we can do anything we believe is necessary and proper, because those were the arguments that Mr. Protege himself, Mr. John Marshall, based on how he was taught by Hamilton, we could imply these powers. We can assume these powers because we find them necessary and proper. And he started literally, perverting and subverting how the Necessary and Proper Clause, the Supremacy Clause, how these things were defined during the ratification debates, and got everybody to believe that they had these powers and this authority. Anyway, this is Madison. It is a great recommendation for this system that it provides against this evil more than any other system known to us, and particularly more than the old system of the Confederation. The most effectual way to guard against a standing army is to render it unnecessary. The most effectual way to render it unnecessary is to give the general government full power to call forth the militia. You see, they have the full power to call forth the militia and exert the whole natural strength of the Union when necessary. Thus, you will furnish the people with sure and certain protection without recurring to this evil. And the certainty of this protection from the whole will be a strong inducement on individual exertion. Does the organization of government warrant a belief that this power will be abused? Can we believe that a government of a federal nature, consisting of co-equal sovereignties, and particularly having one branch chosen from the people, will drag the militia unnecessarily to an immense distance? This, sir, would be unworthy of the most arbitrary despot. They have no temptation whatever to abuse this power. Such abuse could only answer the purpose of exciting the universal indignation of the people and drawing themselves to the general hatred and, detestation. There you go. Detesting. I've never heard this. I've never used this. But the general hatred and the detestation of their country. Interesting. And so Madison goes on about martial law, and he basically says the states have the authority of training. I'm going to reread this. The honorable member has made another mistake. He wishes martial law to be exercised only in time of war under an idea that Congress can establish it in the time of peace. The states are to have the authority of training the militia according to the congressional discipline, and of governing them at all times when not in the service of the Union. Congress is to govern such part of them as may be employed in the actual service of the United States, and such part can only be subject to martial law. So there's a qualifier right there on martial law. Congress is to govern such part of them as can be employed in the actual service in the United States, and such part can be subject to martial law. The gentlemen in opposition have drawn a most tremendous picture of the Constitution in this respect. Without considering that the power was absolutely indispensable, they have alarmed us with the possible abuse of it, but have shown no inducement or motive to tempt them to such abuse. Would the legislature of the state drag the militia of the eastern shore of the western frontiers or those of the western frontiers to the eastern shore? If the local militia were sufficient to effect the intended purpose, there is something so preposterous and so full of mischief in the idea of dragging militia unnecessarily from one end of the continent to the other, that I think there is no ground of apprehension. If you limit their power over the militia, you give them a pretext of substituting a standing army. If you put it in the power of the state governments to refuse the militia by requiring their consent, you destroy the general government and sacrifice particular states. The same principle and motives which produce disobedience to requisitions will produce refusal in this case. The restrictions which the honorable gentleman mentioned to the British Constitution are all provisions against the power of the executive magistrate, but the House of Commons may be so disposed, sacrificed in the interest of their own constituents in all cases. In other words, they may actually, you know, at the demise of the people, give the king what the king wants. They may prolong the duration of mutiny bills and grant supplies to the king to carry on impolitic war. But they have no motives to do so, for they have strong motives to do their duty. We have more ample security than the people of Great Britain. The powers of the government are more limited and guarded, and our representatives are more responsible than the members of the British House of Commons. Now, one of the things that Mr. Clay, and I got to get into this because this is the banter that kind of goes back and forth, but I kind of want to prove this because Mr. Clay, just like Mr. Grayson, happens to be, you know, that difficult to understand something. And Mr. Clay basically stated, by this power, our militia might be sent to Mississippi. He observed that the sheriff might raise the posse comitatus to execute the laws. He feared it would lead to the establishment of a military government, as the militia were to be called forth to put the laws into execution. He asked why this mode was preferred to the old established custom of executing the laws. Madison answered by saying that the power existed in all countries that the militia might be called forth for that purpose under the laws of this state and every state in the Union, that public force must be used when resistance to the laws required it. Otherwise, society itself must be destroyed, that the mode referred to by the gentleman might not be sufficient on every occasion, as the sheriff must be necessarily restricted to the posse of his own county. If the posse of one county were insufficient to overcome the resistance to the execution of laws, this power must be resorted to. He did not by any means admit that the old mode was superseded by the introduction of the new one, and that it was obvious to him that the civil power was sufficient. This mode would never have been in practice. Then Mr. Henry pipes in, and he goes on and on and on, and we will kind of cut it out there because we're not going to pick up what Mr. Henry says because he's a great orator and takes a long time to talk. We will pick up with Mr. Nicholas when we get back in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.